You're probably sick of hearing my voice. I certainly am. I'm sure you could listen to the panelists a bit more, but I'm sure you're bursting at the seams to have your say as well, and that's what we're going to do now for about 30 minutes or so. So I'm going to give these guys the mics to share to save their voices, and hope we can hear you, but if not, I can bring one of these down. But the floor is yours, guys, so go for it.
Yes, Duke, sorry. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. The thing that bothers me about being Christian on the left, and okay, now I haven't doing my stuff yet, but I'm
not. Sorry.
The possibility of getting Christians to talk about economic resources. I mean, I find in my own church, when you talk about the problem, one of the funny things about the church is there's this old saying, like, two things that are unavoidable in life are death and taxes. It doesn't apply to church. The first place the church is eternal. And the second place, we don't pay corporation tax on our dividend, we don't pay capital gains on our dividend, we get paid on our subscriptions. Admittedly, our employees do pay their income tax and so on. Though our rectories are 50% for anything we pay. So actually, and of course, in Ireland, the whole Greek debacle was that it was said time and time again that the Greek Orthodox Church wasn't paying tax. Churches in Britain don't pay taxes, so why are we giving some poor old Greek Orthodox? Anyway, my question is this. Christians are absolutely useless when it comes to economics. And I find this in the church treasure. I find it impossible to get anybody to do the interrogating as to what I'm doing wrong. They just accept everything they're told. And when I talk to them about how we ought to be investing any reserves we have in things that are economically and usefully socially productive, well, the Church of Ireland, which is the church that I have the good fortune to be a member of, that particular church has got things called unit trusts, and there's a lot of money in it, and the income is used usefully. But there is no option within that structure for investing usefully. There's tens of millions of pounds in that. And the revenues from the church is much better than having it in the bank. The bank pays you nothing these days. And I find it very difficult moving bits of the church's money into things that are socially useful. We have good money for wind farms and so on, but it's a very recent idiosyncratic development. It's probably regarded as foolish, but at least I'm independent that it is socially useful. But I don't know how you get through Christians in general about this particular topic. Maybe when the Catholic Church was selling indulgences, at least it was making a link.
Can I just add to that? I found out recently that there was a German banker behind that whole papal indulgence thing. I can't remember his name, but 500 years later, nothing's changed. Sorry.
We did a table quiz in the church quite recently, and I did say to the rector, we find if you go to a table quiz, and I went to one with Claire's father recently in this church, and underneath the table, they've all got their, if you're running a table quiz, they've all got their iPhones. And they're all using the
iPhone.
There were
two
in church table quiz anymore. They didn't say to can we not, knowing they're going to do this, can we not sell them indulgence if they can find good researchers in the table quiz? He wouldn't get me. I think he thought I was going to be got up and mocking the historic Catholic Church in the late history. We do not create money for conversions. We're creating money at quantities and everything else, and we are oblivious to the opportunities of actually making a better world. We're good at raising money for Christian aid, and we do. And that's great, and people will always be generous to that. But when you try to interest them in serious economics and changing our economy and using our money creatively, they just don't know. They're not interested, and you cannot engage with them. If we can find a way of doing that, I think we begin to make some serious changes. Because you will recall a few years ago, there was a big issue here about Presbyterian Mutual, and it screwed up. There were hundreds of millions of pounds in that. There's £1 billion hanging around in building credit unions in Northern Ireland. Churches have got reserves, charities have got reserves. There's a vast amount of economic resource that is at the disposal of people like us, which could do a great deal to change the world we live in, and yet we do nothing about it. Now, if Christians in the depth find a way to do that, I think it'd be a fantastic issue.
Any comments on that, guys? Or
there's just one thing back to 750. Really encouraging thing that's been happening recently is the fossil fuel divestment movement, which has recently raised its profile here in Queens, much to UKIP's horror and disgust. And that's something that's happening in churches as well as in foundations, educational establishments and so on. So that might be one way that people in churches can come to realise, you know, the link between what they do and what's happening across the world. Yeah.
Sure. Richard?
Your story about selling things, actually, and this is not terribly relevant, but it brought immediately to mind something my father taught me at a church fete, and I suspect this is still in the era of pounds, shillings and pence, but I'll put it into a more modern currency. And he sold raffle tickets, which were 10p each or 4 for 50p. And I wasn't very old, and I thought, that doesn't make sense, Dad. He said, yeah, but they buy them for 50p, so don't argue. And yeah, if you say the church doesn't question, you know, people did buy that. And he made this his selling trick for years. I mean, because he was the church treasurer. And if he could raise some money, he'd do it any way he could. And I think you've raised a really, really important point. I mean, thankfully, Quakers do talk about economy. I mean, they really do embrace it in a big way. And actually, it's one of the reasons perhaps why I'm there. And I've just discovered this evening that the fact that I'm a Quaker is in The Guardian. Don't read everything you hear in the press, because The Guardian is speculating that I'm Shadow Chancellor on Monday, by the way. I will tell you I'm not. They haven't noticed I'm not an MP, which is kind of an obstacle to progress on that one, which is very interesting that a national newspaper hasn't got that. But you know, I think there is this reticence. You know, for all my dad's advice that, you know, you can actually sell raffle tickets for any price you liked, he also told me, outside the church, don't talk about religion and never talk about politics. I haven't always followed my dad's advice, as you can see. But we are really good at avoiding that issue, generally. I mean, I've had an Anglican career too, and I still actually go and, you know, take part in the Eucharist in Anglican churches as well. So I might be a Quaker, but I actually have some sacramental elements as well. And you won't find that discussed. And I remember a chap called Peter Sills, who was the Dean of Ely, or no, he was the Deputy Dean of Ely Cathedral. And we tried at one time, Peter and I, to put on a course about economics and faith. And Peter and I sat there hoping that somebody would turn up, and hoping that somebody would turn up. And then we went and had a cup of tea, because that was it, nobody came. Astonishing. And a cathedral could not get somebody to come and talk about it. And I don't know the answer to that. Why won't we see this reality of faith in our lives? And so few Christians think that actually faith matters from Monday to Friday as much as it matters on Sunday morning. And I wish they would.
That's right. I could give you an answer on why based on medieval philosophy, but I'm not going to bore you with that. Douglas, that's for another time. But two things very quickly before we field questions. Positive news. One is I'm happy to announce our next event in February will be on the issue of fossil fuel divestment, because it's time for the Irish churches to divest from fossil fuels. And crucially, as we've said tonight, not just to be anti, i.e. divestment, but to be for something better, reinvesting that in useful things that you're mentioning. The second thing is, they may not have had much success in a course like that at Ely Cathedral, but in my church, along with Stephen Hillis, give us a wave there, Stephen, at the back, we're running what we call a life group or a course at our church in Carrickfergus Vineyard on this issue of democracy and how, as Christians, we get involved, looking at politics, looking at the planet, looking at poverty, and looking at persecution. But yes, how many?
Four,
there we go. That's four changed
well,
opinions.
That's Beely Cathedral.
But yes, you're right. I'll move on quickly, and if we try and keep our comments and questions brief. Because,
Johnny, could I just quickly, very sure. quickly, there is a resource co-authored by Christian Aid called Jubilee Economics, and it's a discussion guide resource for small groups, for churches, and so I definitely recommend that's one way of maybe start trying to start the conversation.
Super. Stephen, yeah. First,
before Claire, of course, we thank you for that. It's really good to have you here.
Social clauses, actually, there was quite a battle over during local government reform and the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 year process that it took to deliver that last year. The then Minister, Alex Atwood, put a lot of effort into social clauses around employing long-term unemployed and people with disabilities, and that aspect of social clauses, and actually the type of thing that we tried to do with Christian Aid in terms of looking into the ethics of businesses is something that wasn't written into the legislation that could kind of go en masse into the local government. So really the executive, I'm not saying they actively blocked it, but when there was a clear effort to try and insert that into the building blocks of standing orders in the councils, it was rejected, and I suppose that's really about the worldview of the dominant forces around that table, and the SDLP obviously just does have one minister. So I think there is room to tinker around the edges, and I know my colleagues in Belfast had one on social clauses around, I think there's been NPSA have been lobbying for one around boycott and divest, and obviously people have different views on that campaign, but there wasn't anything, and there was actually a resistance to putting anything into local government reform. So it really is each of the 11 councils finding something that suits them.
Yes.
I'm a member of the party for over 40 years, and so I'm happy to know that I think it's the same. In fact, the party council, when they started, I actually interrupted them, and I've done that time and time again. Now, Stuart Dixon, if you want to get to Tim, he is the one that always chief whip. He doesn't agree with corporate. You probably know that already.
Thank you. That's good. And like I say, there's room for all views. I will go out and sell the party line when we democratically agree with it. But I was pleased to note that it was, it's about the concept of taking the powers and not specifically reducing them. And I think that's not just me saying that, that's reflected in recent press releases. But I'll make sure to dig out Stuart Dixon. I met him in the All Party Group in the National Congress.
Well, the only thing about Drake, yes, I think that there's a beggar, from a Christian point of view, there's a beggar like neighbour, and it's certain big companies which can't against small companies which want to do it, and big companies which don't want to do it, and it's certain them against each other. Personally, I think we should have a EC of maybe something like 20% or 18% minimum, and then that would solve the problem. And what the Republic would have to raise their tax, but they could be compensated in some other way. The other thing is, really, Richard, about your economic thing. What I prefer to call Bernie Sanders in the America, at least he bases it on the Nordic countries. His ideas is far from what they get on the Nordic countries. Now, hopefully, he will become president, but it's a very low probability. But he is based on something that actually works. What worries me about this carbon economic? There's no country in the world that operates like that. And to my mind, we have to operate with something that actually seems to work. And the Nordic social democratic countries work. And of course, Scotland was the Scottish National Republic. Not that Glasgow was the same as Copenhagen, obviously. But what I'm saying is, the problem with Corbyn, to my mind, is he may be well making an old estimate, but you have to base it on something that actually works. And that's my problem, why I don't think certainly the corporation tax anything. You know, we have to run something else. But the other thing about Christian Aid, I'll slightly run it down.
If we can keep our comments brief, if you finish up, please.
When they come out of churches and show you these nice villages and all, and church and people like that, a lot of the things I see in Al Jazeera, people in a lagoon in Lagos, which is 15 million people, it's grown so rapidly. And I had to turn off the Al Jazeera after 3 quick shots after 4 seconds, because it was just postponed, but physically sick. You know, it's all right to see this nice building, it's no rest. But these positive medicines for people who are living in $1 a day and still in the lagoon in Lagos, and the rich are living in big places with electric fences and all the rest of it, and guards and roofs and all to stop people coming in. To my mind, you know, do you not show that sort of thing because of it's so horrible that people wouldn't give money? You know, it really seems that you're concentrating on these outlying villages and things, when these people smile and all. Because you don't want to show the horror of somewhere like people living in the stilts in Lagos.
Dave, do you want to respond?
Okay. Christian Aid in our sort of communications, I suppose we always try to show the impact of the work that's happening overseas. So we're trying to show people. These are areas where our partners are working, where they're making a difference, and this is the result of development work. This is the positive side of what can happen if you support this kind of work overseas. So you will often see in Christian Aid communication, Christian Aid materials, you'll often see pictures of people who are who have been empowered, who are actively working to improve their lives, and we want to show pictures. We want to show dignified pictures as well. We want to show pictures that challenge stereotypes about poverty, that show that people who are living in poverty are actually they're not the kind of helpless victims. That actually they do have the ability to kind of find solutions to their own problems, to work their way out of poverty. So we're trying to show that kind of side of things. But that doesn't mean that we should shy away from showing the realities of poverty in the world and the scandal of poverty. And we are very clear that we believe poverty in the world is a scandal, that it shouldn't exist, and that there is absolutely no reason why we should accept that we should live in a world where there's enough for everyone, and yet many people do not have even the most basic of human rights. And so we don't shy away from that. If you look at some of the material that is on Christian Aid's website at the moment regarding the refugee crisis and the Syrian crisis appeal that we have there, there are some hard-hitting, real stories of the impact of poverty and conflict. So we do show that side as well, but we're also careful not to use images of people just as a fundraising tool. You know, we don't want to use images of people in their most desperate suffering just as a way of kind of breaking people's hearts so they'll give us more money. You know, that just seems like a wrong thing to do morally. And so we shy away from using people in that way as objects. But we want to show people as empowered to seek a better future for themselves. But there is a line. You know, because we want to show the scandal of poverty, but at the same time, we don't want to use people as a fundraising tool. We want to recognise their dignity as human beings.
Thanks, Dave. Richard, you had a comment?
Can I make a very brief response to the comment about Bernie Sanders and his campaign to be US president?
where he is actually ahead of Hillary Clinton at the moment in the Iowa primary polls. His main economic advisor is somebody called Professor Stephanie Kelton. She and I are in regular touch. Bernie Sanders wanted to get in touch with Jeremy Corbyn and said, how do I do it? And Stephanie said, well, that's not hard, I know Richard. We are talking to each other, there are links. Obviously, the policies are different to suit the different circumstances, but I assure you there are commonalities as well.
Super, yes. And then?
A number of people mentioned corporation tax and also tax avoidance, tax evasion. One of the biggest companies that's doing that is Apple. And in a three-year recent period, they routed $74 billion through the cyber. They didn't pay 20% or even 12%, they paid 0%. They paid no tax on that money anywhere in the world. Could we as Christians, as individuals, as churches, as organizations, as a council, avoid boycott companies like Apple, really make a point? Because they are criminal in what they're doing. It's legal, but ethically it's completely wrong. Could we do something like that?
Folks, any thoughts?
Well, I know it's something I'm constantly aware of.
I have a brick.
But I think I like that concept, and as Christopher said, we're tackling, we need to tackle the infrastructure. So rather than our individual boycotts would be howling at the moon, it's better that we try and basically seize the mechanisms that allow us to change that tax regime and advocate for that. I think, you know, I'm not saying boycotts shouldn't be used as a tool, but I think they would be a literal drop in the ocean with an organisation like Apple that are in all our lives. I'm possibly saying that just to justify my own addiction to their beautiful white rabbit, but I think it is about advocating, lobbying, winning power, changing.
Sure. Yes.
If you listen, and as Richard was saying earlier, one of the reasons that he's always on the Stephen Noble show talking about this is because there's so few of us who want to talk about it, and I've done it with the set of debates. If you listen to the media discourse, you think that before Northern Ireland in brief, it was more corporations.
Yes.
And as we've heard tonight, that's simply not the case. So I just got the very general question. Has anyone in the panel got any ideas about how we can filter this side of the debate back into the public discourse?
Folks, is that the cracker? That's right. Well, I mean, today's event earlier, there were maybe 25, 30, and then about 10 or 15 students. And the earlier event was really targeted at engaged stakeholders. There were people there involved with unions, a lot of academics, people working for various NGOs, what have you. So in terms of will they go and be multipliers in whatever jurisdiction they work, yes, I think they will. But the groupthink that Richard and others have talked about is quite remarkable. And yes, both within the church and without the church, we need to be having these conversations and about real bread and butter issues, not just stuff.
I think that the problem is even worse south of the border. You know, you are a traitor if you suggest a change to the 12.5% tax rate in the Republic. You just can't do that. It's just, you know, it's much, much more of an article of faith than it could ever be here. It is as if the whole of Ireland would sink, because if in the middle of the trickle-up there is 12.5% written, you know, somehow, that is so fundamental to the national identity that, you know, this is what Ireland is all about. And as I pointed out earlier today, it was yesterday afternoon, actually, the whole of the Irish economy is built on the idea of those flows which Apple and its likes are doing, and which I've been involved in exposing. I mean, I was the person who worked with Jesse Drucker to put the Google story around the world. And it took a bit of effort, and it took some risk as well, by the way, because we didn't know the money ended up in Bermuda when we first wrote it thinking, oh, we hope we're right, because they've got a mighty big checkbook if we're wrong. We were right, it was where it went. There is just nobody down there who's willing to stand up, because it's such a big risk. You're a social pariah. And yet, what Ireland is doing is just living off the rent, which is extracted in economic terms. It's called an economic rent. There's this money flowing through, and they're taking a little bit off the top, which is keeping the Irish economy, the Republic's economy, going. Suppose the whole economy of the world changes, and actually we realise that these rent flows are no longer socially acceptable. Ireland will be in deep, deep trouble. 10 years ago, I made that forecast of another tax haven, and I do think the Republic is a tax haven. I'm going to be in a documentary by David Williams and RTE later this month, where I say that, for which reason I'm sure I will not be welcome again in Dublin. It's going to be particularly notorious if I am doing something by then, slightly more publicly, which I didn't know about when I recorded it in July. I made a forecast that Jersey would fail in 2005. Jersey does the same thing. It's a tax haven, and it lives off the rents of money flowing through it into the City of London. That's how it survives. And I said, that is eventually going to fail you because there will be an economic crisis, and there was, and you will not be able to, because I and others are going to expose what you're doing, and you will not be able to extract as much money. And earlier this year, they announced that they have a massive budget deficit, 125 million. It doesn't sound very much, but when their total state income is 450 million, that's enormous, their state deficit. Phenomenal. And it was almost exactly the number I forecast a decade ago, which sort of was a bit almost like the flu. But let me just say, told you so. And they have no idea how to solve it. I'll tell you about another tax haven, because these places are so destructive of themselves, which is why you simply cannot afford to take the risk, because I think Ireland has taken this risk. In the Cayman Islands, 54,000 people, they now have a charity that has to provide free school lunches for quite a large proportion of the children on the island. Because they are so poor, that is the only way they can get a main meal. The social division is so enormous because of the fact that there's a very small who are extracting all the rents, and they're then not passing those on to others. Trickle down doesn't work on Cayman. That they've got to this point where they're having to rely on charity to feed the children of the island. You know, how absurd is that? And this model of actually living off these illicit, I use the term carefully, illicit financial flows, not illegal, but actually unethical financial flows, is bankrupting these states morally and actually. And I fear that is what could happen in the Republic. So for heaven's sake, they are not the model to follow. Northern Ireland has to actually release the potential within itself by investing to actually let out the entrepreneur within, which I think is in Northern Ireland. The trouble is, a lot of entrepreneurs within Northern Ireland go to England to do it. Just come back and do it here.
Two very quick comments, and then we'll take another question. One, I think the church needs to rediscover the Old Testament prophetic model, where the prophets of the Old Testament spoke out, and they spoke out about a lot of issues, but they spoke out on issues of economic justice to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. The second thing is, I read this joke recently. There was a banker and a worker and a refugee, and there was a pot of 20 coins, and the banker took 19 coins and said to the worker, "Look at that greedy migrant trying to take that coin," sort of missing the point. So I think it's, I just wanted to throw that in there. But when it comes to a lot of this financial stuff, and it's the poor, whether the poor in this land or the poor in other lands who want to come here fighting for the scraps that come from the table, whereas really there's enough wealth in this world for everyone, everywhere, forever to live well. You had a question.
I wanted to ask you, if I was doing an investment here in Northern Ireland, and I got a team around me, we were to consider where we would place it. The immediate thought would be, let's base it in the south. We do the work here, but we base it in the south because of the tax rate. The problem applies again when I look at people from America who get in touch with me and want to do something. And we want to stuff in Northern Ireland because we feel there's a need to business here. But every case, the question is, what's the tax rate and why don't we do it through the south? And I don't have an answer to it. Are you rich?
You know,
so I can't turn around.
Well, actually, you can't use the South to invest in the North. Let me be blunt about that. If you're trying to do that, actually, you're trying to do something which isn't technically legally possible. If you're trading in the North, you have to pay tax on the profits you make in the North.
Right.
You can actually have an intermediate holding company in the South, I would agree. Whether that would be of great benefit to you in overall tax terms, I'm not sure.
Right.
I could think about it. I could write you an opinion. It would be very expensive. that was a joke, by the way, just for the record, because somebody will otherwise take it the wrong way and it'll appear in the Guardian tomorrow, and it won't be true. The truth is, actually, I mean, I gave some evidence, and I told this, but I will be brief, we'll come towards the end of the evening. I gave some evidence in the House of Lords a couple of years ago. And the head of tax at Ernst & Young, one of the big four firms of accountants in the world, was asked, how important is tax in business decision-making when it comes to location? And he gave what I think was a completely honest answer. And he said, oh, fifth or sixth. And I think he was right, because I've made those decisions in my time. And what is the real thing that you look for, first of all? A skilled workforce, good infrastructure, enforceable contracts and law, stable economy, currency, trained workforce, you know, and good health service so they turn up in the morning and all those other things. They're far more important than actually the tax rate. And do you know what? They're the things that tax pays for, in by and large. That's actually the best indication that there is a bargain between business and the community for which business should make its contribution. Because if they are deciding to come to Northern Ireland, they'll want all those things, train people, forceful law, infrastructure, you've got good broadband, and everything else. And without those, they won't come. But the state provides that underpinning, and then they build on top of it. And that's what's so important. And actually, to look at that one, and it's about these things, if you're really interested, read a book by a professor called Mariana Mazzucato, which is not the easiest name to say. She wrote a book called The Entrepreneurial State. And what she shows is that actually 90% of the technology in an Apple phone was created by government investment, not by Apple. And actually, you know, there's an argument, oh, the state doesn't do anything good. Yeah, actually, it's really good at creating really good technology and training and people and universities. And that's why business must make its fair contribution, because they cream off the benefit and aren't willing to pay for it. That's an unfair bargain, and we have to make a fair and ethical bargain, which is one of the things I think you were talking about as well. What is the right bargain in ethical terms?
Certainly. Two final questions, folks. Then we're going to break for coffee, so there'll be time for further discussion. So yes, sir, this gentleman. Yeah, sorry.
Okay. I think there's. I know we talk about tax, but I think there's something that's kind of missing from the conversation, and it's very evident in the way that the debate around corporation tax has been pitched in the context of Northern Ireland, and it's been very directly by the Treasury and by KPMG spokespeople, all the people that Richard were referring to, the case that they've made to advance corporation tax has been on the back of the Welfare Reform Act of 2012. These two things have been coupled together. And why this is important, I think, in the context of this kind of moral conversation, is because whatever the details of the 2012 welfare reform act in terms of what it's going to do to remove money from people, it introduces, it ratchets up the disability regime for claimants, it ratchets up the punitive aspects of the social security system in such a way that, you know, for the last 2 years we've had deep controversy around sanctions regime in Russia, and there's been all these disputes about whether the Department of Work and Pensions actually revealed the case reviews they've done, the number of deaths that have happened to people following benefits being withdrawn, the number of suicides that have taken place, and so on. And you see this in the case of the Treasury. See this. case that the economic reform group has approached. They say that it's not just that we want to introduce a differential rate of immigration, but a necessary part of that is welfare reform, which is going to push the kind of the people who are on benefits at the moment into the hands of the foreign direct investments. I mean, one figure is 90,000 jobs are going to be created over the next 5 to 10 years, and of course you look at the figures and think, well, there aren't 90,000 unemployed people, so where are those people going to come from? And I said, well, only a fifth of the people are going to come from the unemployed. The rest are actually the long-term sick, disabled people, people that are actually retired. They're going to be pulled back into this. They're not going to be attracted into those jobs. They're going to be forced into those jobs through benefit sanctioning regimes and so on. So this is a very punitive and pernicious attitude towards people that are claimants. And this is the other side of the ideology that promotes the corporation tax regime, an extremely negative and pernicious attitude toward the poor.
Yep. Thank you. Great comment. Andy, do you want to finish? Final comment.
So part of the problem with triple-down economics is that the whole theory behind it relies on demand existing in the economy. But if you've got a situation, as in Italy, where the whole thing with neoliberalism is that it's, as you said, it's entirely individualistic. So it's all about getting as much money and to help with the consequences for everybody else. It's the one person around is you. So the deal, which ought to exist, whereby you can make rich millions, as long as you don't exploit people by underpaying them, or forcing your suppliers to accept ridiculously low rates, and avoiding tax in any other possible way. When that breaks down, then demand gets suppressed, as we've seen. And Castle talked in his last budget speech about making it a highway rich economy. And his idea of paying something that's needed the living wage was very smart, but it was still rather hypocritical for a government of that union to make any comment about wages, having essentially encouraged people to pay less by not, because paying less because it's never a fair arrangement in the first place.
No.
Because the fair arrangement, because the what being done was equals. You go and make a arrangement, you get a go and agree for something that you're good job for. But they are usually in a buyer's market, and they are the buyer. And they say, okay, right, I'll pay you £12 for that 4 hours work. And that was not a problem. Whereas the worker might be worth 20, because they were the only person, or that was the best offer they could get, they had to drop the £12 for the work, and they just, or 12 masterclass to go back to the old currency. And in that situation, when real revenues get cut, then demand gets suppressed, and they go back up to the top, and businesses can say, I have a spare cash. But then it's fine, it's an investment.
Yes.
In the bank.
Yes.
And that is where the whole driven down thing, to the extent that it ever works, breaks them all together.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why they need to say that is about the loan is, first of all, I'm going to transport assembly and the bill cost.
Thank you, Andy. That's a very valid point.
I'm certain it's all to get right. I'm sure that's all of them are.
Thank you. So, folks, on behalf of Christians on the Left, can I sincerely thank our special guest, Richard Murphy, for fitting us into what is a very busy schedule. But also our panel of local pundits as well. Thank you, guys. We've gone over, so I'll be very brief. In light of all that's been said tonight and of the choices, because they are choices set before us, let me close very briefly by paraphrasing John Kenneth Galbraith to fit the context. The modern religious fiscal conservative in Northern Ireland is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy, that is, the attempt to find a superior moral, even biblical, justification for selfishness. But we'll not end there tonight, for we refuse to be defined by negativity or fear, even when we must speak prophetic truth to those we love and worship with. For as much as we desire to see the systemic spirit of stinginess that hangs so heavy upon this land broken, we desire even more to see an abundant spirit of generosity take its place. An abundant spirit of generosity that gives and gives and gives again without thought of reward or ulterior motive, in natural imitation of the very heart of God. That's our superior moral justification for selflessness. So friends, let us end tonight as we began. We're here tonight because we love this land, its woods and hills and little rivers. We're here tonight because we love this land, its people and its places, its creatures and its communities. And we're here tonight because we deeply, deeply desire to see this land that we love flourish, and to do so in a manner that does not prevent other lands from flourishing too. And so in the words of Porrig O'Toole, so you might as well live and you might as well love, you might as well love, you might as well love. In closing, folks, may our Heavenly Father bless you and keep you, and may give you peace both now and forevermore. Please do join us for coffee afterwards. Otherwise, thank you for coming. Safe home and good night.